Episode 7. People sometimes ask me where my Jamaican ancestors actually came from. Well, since my great-aunt Mel, remember her, was born in 1904, and my grandmother, Maudriana Lenora Parks, who I never knew, was her older sister. Logically, grandmother Maud would have been born 1900 or earlier. Anyway, the bottom line is that her ancestors and Esther's ancestors, and thus my ancestors, would have been enslaved Africans, initially the Akan people, including the Ashanti, from the Gold Coast, present-day Republic of Ghana. And they were followed by an even greater number of Igbo people, mainly from Nigeria. So, how did Africans end up in Jamaica anyway? Well, in May 1494, Christopher Columbus sets sail for the East Indies, winds up in the West Indies, lands in Jamaica, and claims the island for Spain. The original inhabitants of Jamaica were Taino Indians from South America, who had named the island Saimaka, meaning land of wood and water.
Columbus had heard about Jamaica from Cubans who described it as the land of blessed gold.
He and his men beat, rape and torture the natives in their crazed search for, as it turns out, non-existent, blessed gold.
The Spanish grossly mismanaged the island, and the natives are completely wiped out by brutal treatment and diseases.
And are replaced with my ancestors' ancestors, stolen from Africa. Land of wood and of water, of alluvial and wetlands on coastal plains. A tree grows in the rainforest, shrouded in the mist. The next major upheaval comes in 1655, when the British capture Jamaica from the Spanish.
The British also import enslaved Africans to maintain their newly acquired sugarcane production industry.
So, there you go, a shortish answer to the question of where my ancestors came from. Let me tell you about another of my early childhood memories from Jamaica. It's one that keeps returning, like a recurring dream.
Fade in.
I'm in the woods near the house. Slingshots are aimed. Stones swoop. A bird is struck.
Zoom in.
It falls to the ground. Noiseless shouts. Birds roasting. Smoke, dampness.
Fade out.
Fade in.
I'm in the woods near the house.
Slingshots are aimed.
Stones swoop.
A bird is struck.
Zoom
in. It falls to the ground.
Noiseless shouts.
Birds roasting. Smoke.
Fade out.
Fade in.
Fade out. Speaking about that memory has reminded me of a dreamlike night in Jamaica, one I haven't thought about in ages. I must have been, what, 5? It's dusk, and night is falling fast. Winkies, fireflies, twinkle and blink like stars against the darkening sky. I'm in a field, or is it someone's yard? The glow of flaming torches attached to stakes stuck in the ground flutter in the breeze, lighting up the faces of people chatting, chanting, swaying, milling around. There's some sort of ceremony going on. A heady cocktail of odours, roast breadfruit, rum punch, molasses, pervades the air. A hand pats me on the head, pats my springy hair. A bunch of men are carrying what looks like a halved tree trunk above their heads. I hear people speak of what sounds like Ninite, and I later realise they were saying Ninite, a funerary tradition originating from Africa, a sort of extended wake, a celebration of a lost loved one, allowing the deceased spirit, which needs to be protected, to move on. On the 9th night after death, the deceased person's bed and mattress are leaned up against a wall to encourage their evil shadow, their duppy, to leave the house forevermore and enter the grave. Let me give you a few tips, some do's and don'ts, when it comes down to dealing with duppies. Cover all mirrors in the dead room to prevent the dead from seeing the reflection of the living.
This prevents the living from pining away.
If you place 10 coffee beans in the dead room, no duppy can enter.
Because duppies can only count to 9.
Make sure all family members say goodbye to the corpse, and that every child is lifted and passed over the coffin while their name is being said.
Otherwise, the spirit of the dead will return to haunt the family members.
Do not let tears fall on the body.
Otherwise, the ghost will return to haunt the mourner.
Do not allow the body to be kissed. Otherwise, the teeth of the kisser will rot. You must sew up the pockets of the dead. Otherwise, their ghost will fill their pockets with stones from limbo to lapidate the living. When you leave awake, simply touch a person who is to leave with you. Do not announce it. Otherwise, the duppy will follow you home. As a precaution, you should also walk backwards and turn around 3 times, because a duppy can only walk in straight lines.
Jamaican Patois is an English-based Creole language with West African, Taino, Irish, Spanish, Hindi, Portuguese, Chinese...
With my Jamaican-born relatives, I always spoke Patois. It contains many loanwords, mostly of African origin, mainly from the Igbo people, such as duppy, is from the word dupon, for cotton tree root, because of the African belief that malicious spirits originate in tree roots, and obia, for witchcraft. Our accents soften up over the years, but we can exaggerate it when we don't want outsiders to understand what we're saying.
1966.
In a South London hospital, my half-brother Stephen is born. His Barbadian father, Hunter, is as heartless as they come. My mother will be forever convinced he stole some of her hair to work bad obia on her, to make sure she can never get rid of him until he is ready to move on. She also wonders how she ended up with this small island man in the first place.
In the hierarchy of the islands, Jamaicans, who tend to regard Jamaica as superior to Barbados, refer to it disparagingly as small island.
Hunter has other children, back home in Barbados and in England, but supports none of them or their mothers properly. On the contrary, he shamelessly sniffs out and steals housekeeping money my mother has hidden in crooks and crannies. She wonders, perhaps seriously, if he hasn't trained himself to detect the odour of money, like a tracker dog. In a lighter moment, she demonstrates how she imagines him, nose in the air, sniffing around the room when we're not around. She even hides pound notes between the sacred pages of her hidden Bible, and she asks God to please smite the bugger down if he goes as far as stealing from the Bible.
However, he does steal from the Bible.
He is never struck down. He goes on to live a long and carefree life.
No thunderbolts from the heavens strike him.
No justice.
No fire.
No justice.
Nor brimstone.
There is no justice. Through obia, recklessness, or just plain fate, my mother has a second child, Hazel, with him 2 years later. After our mother's passing, my brother and I find in her belongings a dark brown vintage leather handbag. It's stuffed with old papers and other bits and bobs, including an incongruous 6-inch nail. We are fairly sure we know what, or rather, who, it was meant for.
The mid-1970s.
Over the years, Vera's absence has become increasingly present. And then, one autumn afternoon, ding dong, it's Vera. Double surprise. She's accompanied by a man she announces she intends to marry. Her hubby-to-be is pale, shaky and frail. But what kind of damn foolishness is this? Asks Goddy May. Vera needs a strong, solid man, she continues, not this weak boy who can barely stand up. We try to convince Vera to reflect, to reconsider, but she clearly intends to tie the knot as soon as possible. There's something distinctly secty about the whole affair. From this moment on, Vera will distance herself from the family, even further.